Chapter 12, The Rising Tide of Color. By the time I was in junior high school, I was convinced that racial differences are real and inherent, and that the forced integration of our schools and society would have dire consequences. It seemed obvious that America would undergo a slow transformation to a racially mixed society with a corresponding demographic change similar to that of ancient Egypt and ancient India. Perhaps there was time, I thought, even if it took a few generations, to rally the European American to the truth and thus prevent the looming tragedy. I hoped that the increasing scientific evidence of racial realities would eventually prevail and turn our nation in the direction of self-preservation. However, the material I read suggested that we had not nearly that much time. I read the books of Madison Grant and Lothrop Stoddard, written in the early decades of this century, which predicted a, quote, rising tide of color, and, quote, the passing of the great race, unquote, which they said would be caused by high minority immigration and birth rates. Their warnings were helpful in securing passage of that Great Immigration Restriction Bill of 1917 and the one in 1924, and even the Walter McCarran Immigration Bill of 1952, which passed the U.S. Congress over the veto of President Harry S. Truman. The restrictionist legislation was not meant to make America an all-white nation. It simply attempted to preserve the racial status quo in America. Shortly after the 1952 legislation passed, Eisenhower, and perhaps the high point of his presidential career, acted decisively to stop a massive influx of Mexicans and return them south of the border. Up until the mid-1960s, America was almost 90% white, a figure rigorously maintained for two-thirds of that century. So it seemed that events had at least muted some of the predictions of Grant, Stoddard, and others. Most of the immigrants of the early 20th century may not have been of the founding Anglo-Saxon heritage, but they were certainly Caucasians of European origin. And by the 1960s, the overwhelming majority of them had thoroughly assimilated into the Anglo-American culture. The English language reigned supreme among all European-American ethnic groups. Then in the mid-1960s, the American government embarked on three important policies that would severely threaten the future of European Americans. The government, under the presidency of Lyndon Johnson, inaugurated 1. Massive forced integration of schools and neighborhoods, 2. Taxpayer subsidizing of massive welfare-financed illegitimate birth rates, disproportionately high among minorities, and 3. Scrapping America's immigration laws and adopting policies that favored massive non-European immigration. All three policies had a powerful demographic effect on America. Carlton Putnam and many others tried to warn America about the consequences of these policies. In my own way, I tried to do the same thing, but as a high school student, I felt helpless. Rather than go into all the arguments that convinced me that America's demographic change would have terrible consequences, I will relate a personal experience. After my election to Louisiana House of Representatives in 1989, I visited my old grade school neighborhood, Gentilly Woods, once tidy and well-kept. It was now mostly black and disheveled. Many of the homes that once had a perpetually fresh-painted look, they were now blistered and peeling and garnished by unkempt lawns of weeds and trash. I learned from the few European-American holdouts in my old neighborhood that burglary, vandalism, and assault, which had once been very rare, were now commonplace. As I drove slowly down my old street, groups of hard-featured black men stood around dilapidated cars and directed hostile stares at an obviously unknown white person trespassing in their neighborhood. They were right, for I was now trespassing where I no longer belonged. I looked at the burned-out shell of a home where once lived Mr. and Mrs. Aiken, and when I passed the old Markton family home, I could hardly see the place. The front yard was covered with trash and 4-foot weeds. The die-hard white remnants who remained knew that things had changed over the years, but they had adapted and found a way to endure each indignity and violation. The change had been so gradual that they were no longer shocked at what went on, just resigned to it. Even though it had been a few years since my last visit, my memories became vivid as I entered the boundaries of the neighborhood. It seemed as though I had been away only a few scant hours. Now those old memories crashed against the images of the present, causing me to feel disoriented and off balance. It was akin to visiting a healthy friend and then, after only a few weeks separation, seeing him wasting away with illness. Afraid that my recollection had idealized the neighborhood of my youth, as soon as I returned to my suburban home, I ferreted out my old photographs. And those photos clearly showed a community even more attractive than I had remembered. Well-kept homes filled the album, often accented with blooming flowers and finely trimmed shrubbery, sidewalks edged closely, and homes with a freshly painted look. Clean and polished automobiles dotted the clean streets, even more dramatic, were the photographs of the Tom Sawyer and Becky Thatcher, like bright faces of the children with whom I spent so many happy hours of childhood. In my youth, these were the ruddy faces that ruled our streets and yards and parks. They were all gone now, replaced by dark, angry teenagers with scarred skin and boomboxes, often with pistols and crack in their pockets. Menacing the streets where children now feared to venture. This is a picture that has been frequently repeated all over the United States of America. The story of the remnant white residents of Gentilly Woods is much like that of the frog in the pot of water. The temperature increases so slowly that the poor creature fails to recognize the danger until the water is boiling and it's too late. Does the story not apply to the traditional American? Are white Americans too lulled by the tepid water not to realize what is ahead? Americans can glimpse their country's future by looking at the inner cities. The political corruption, failing schools, drug problems, crime, the rundown housing, and even the trash in the streets all are a preview of the coming attractions of mid and late 20th century America as a whole. When all of America has the same racial proportions as that of the inner cities, there will be no white infrastructure, no white cornucopia of tax revenue mitigating the third worldism. Criminals will no longer be held in check by white police and white prosecutors and white juries and judges, and the shrinking criminal justice system and the jails needed to house the lawbreakers. Those races that cannot provide for their own housing, food, medical care, and schooling will no longer have them generously provided by the aging and diminishing European population. As bad as conditions were in the inner cities at the close of the 20th century, how much worse will they be without the almost sacrificial support of a productive white America? When all of America is made up of the genotypes of the inner city, America will mutate into a land somewhere between Mexico and Haiti. The transition might be similar to the Haitian Revolution. Because of the clear racial demarcation that often accompanies the haves and have-nots, a revolutionary proletarian fervor of the dark masses will have a clear target, people of light skin. Fires of racial hatred and envy are stoked by those who can only blame black and brown failure on white racism and oppression, never facing the reality of racial difference. Whether non-white ascendancy comes about through massive violence, such as the genocide of the whites in Haiti at the end of the 18th century, or by the sheer numbers in the voting booths, it will have the same devastating effect to America. Unless circumvented, the non-white racial revolution ahead will leave America a land unrecognizable and abhorrent to the remaining minority, an ever-shrinking minority, of white citizens. As I related earlier, perhaps a true harbinger of the America of the future is the capital city of our country, Washington, D.C. In spite of almost unlimited monetary support from the whole of the American people, it is one of the most poorly educated, dirtiest, and most dangerous cities in America. The city's mayor of the 1990s, now finally out of office, was a crack-smoking whoremaster who was reelected after his drug and sex convictions. An American Haiti or Mexico is not inevitable. White Americans can avoid such fate if they once again gain control over their government, their media, and their borders in the last few decades of the 21st century. Even after whites become demographically outnumbered, because of our intelligence and organizational ability, for perhaps a generation, there will still be more than enough whites to prevail in an evolutionary or revolutionary physical struggle, but only if we're racially awakened and strong in will and purpose. But the fewer our numbers, the greater the suffering and sacrifice expended in the future battle for our survival and our freedom. The longer our people delay, the harder the fight that we, and even more so our children, will face. In the last years of the 20th century, white Americans have been incredibly indifferent to the most critical issue facing the country, its rapid transformation from an overwhelmingly white nation to a non-white nation. In a democratic form of government, such a change has the potential to turn the society upside down, and the process is well underway in the America of the late 1990s. Not limited to America, a dramatic demographic upheaval is also occurring in Canada, England, Australia, France, and many other white nations. In addition to all the racially related factors, uncontrolled immigration transforms America from a spacious and resource-rich nation to a far more crowded and environmentally damaged nation. No sizable nation in the history of the world has ever undergone such a sweeping population shift in so short a period. Equally astonishing is the ignorance among the American people of this seminal change. The mass media treat this seismic shift almost as if it is inconsequential. When they mention it at all, they portray the change as one that will benefit our economy and culturally enrich us. Some members of our heritage, those who dwell in communities and neighborhoods that are still almost all white, think the rest of America is unaffected, as is their own neighborhood. But the change is not only in the streets of Miami, Los Angeles, or Detroit. It even finds its expressions in the rising crime rates and school problems of recently all-white communities, such as the remote Fargo, North Dakota, or Des Moines, Iowa. In reality, this demographic change will be catastrophic to both our genotype and the Western society that our European heritage created. The two engines of the seminal change are massive non-white immigration and differential birth rates between whites and non-whites. The non-white immigration rates and welfare-spawned birth rates are not the accidental result of some natural process. They are the result of government policies that are racially discriminatory against those of European descent. Next section, the alien invasion. Most experts believe that whites will become a minority in the United States by 2050. Many projections have that landmark coming even earlier, by a decade or more, as the percentage of racial change becomes more rapid. Already, the non-white population is increasing faster than predicted. Unless government policy changes, and changes radically, by the time the students of the white high school class of 2000 reach retirement age, they and their children will find themselves outnumbered and outvoted not just in our major cities, but in America as a whole. More than 95% of both legal and illegal immigration into the United States is non-white. Because of the way the immigration law is structured, the highest skilled nations on earth, those of Europe, are allowed only a tiny percentage of immigrants, while the third world nations, such as Mexico, are dumping their chaff onto our American shores at the highest rate in history. Additionally, the federal government has been unwilling to enforce our immigration laws and prevent the annual immigration of more than 1 million illegal aliens, overwhelmingly non-white. America also has a burgeoning welfare system that is financing a prolific non-white, predominantly black and Hispanic birth rate. The result is a demographic change that challenges the cultural and economic foundations that has characterized America from its founding to the present day. Many Americans labor under the false impression that American immigration policy is selective for skills and abilities. In fact, the great bulk of legal immigration has nothing to do at all with skills. It is based on, quote, family reunification. And the foreign reunified family members can be illiterate, insane, or even HIV positive. Because of allotment numbers, family reunification actually prevents many Europeans with exceptional skills and abilities from immigrating. Of course, in the area of illegal immigration, no selection standards exist at all. Many of those pouring in illegally are criminals or parasites who come here for the classic reason offered by the robber when asked why he robbed banks. Because that's where the money is. He reminds me of the quote of the Jewish communist master spy Lincoln Trebisch, who, entering Germany from Soviet Russia, remarked, "I'm looking for a fatherland. Where can I find one cheap?" Even the so-called skilled immigrants hailing from third world nations, where standards are far lower, are usually less qualified than their American counterparts. For example, better qualified American-born PhDs face discrimination at colleges across America that are hiring non-American, non-white university teachers to accomplish their minority hiring goals. The mass media celebrate the racial change with constant parading of immigrant success stories. Newspapers feature stories about high school valedictorians and successful entrepreneurs, sometimes with full-page picture spreads of the beaming smiles of the alien newcomers and their large families. But how often do the media correlate immigration with a far more common immigrant reality of crime? Every immigrant valedictorian can be contrasted with hundreds of dope dealers, robbers, murderers, and organized crime members. Each immigrant millionaire entrepreneur can be contrasted with hundreds mired in the welfare system, their greatest productive talent being the churning out of babies nursed at the collective breast of productive Americans. The media constantly offer up successful immigrants as proof that the, quote, American dream is alive and well. But they never offer a clear picture of the immigrant version of the American nightmare. Such could be the story of Colin Ferguson, a white-hating, illegal immigrant obtaining residence through marriage and ultimately gunning down 25 people on New York's Long Island Railroad. Instead of being an argument to reduce immigration, President Clinton and other liberals used the Ferguson incident to call for gun control. Liberals focusing on the number of guns rather than the number and quality of immigrants is a perfect example of the incoherence of the establishment. The pervasive crime in America is unrelated to the number of guns. It's related to the number of racial minorities. As noted earlier, A comparison of American and European crime statistics clearly reveal that the eager white gun buyers of America have nearly the same low crime rate as the gun banned whites of Europe. A disproportionate amount of crime is commonly committed by aliens in America. Fully one-fourth of the prisoners in federal penitentiaries are not American citizens, proportionately three times higher than it should be for their percentages of the population. As staggering as these figures are, they do not include aliens who have been naturalized or the teenage or adult children of aliens born in America who are by birth citizens. Although one might suppose that most of the aliens are incarcerated for drug importation, the fact is that upwards to four-fifths are in federal prison for drug dealing within the United States of America. Aliens dominate an incredibly disproportionate amount of the drug trafficking in America. In fact, from transportation to distribution, combining the Nigerian heroin connection with the Russian Jewish mafia from Russia, the South American cartels and the black street dealers, one of the most severe problems facing the United States is of a distinctly minority character. America's recent experience with Nigerian immigrants offers a grim look into the current immigration policy of the federal government that could be described only as self-destructive. U.S. law enforcement officials estimate that 75% of the 100,000 Nigerians in the United States are involved in serious criminal activity and account for 40% of all heroin smuggled into the United States. If government officials admit that three out of four Nigerian immigrants are criminals, yet they continue to let them in to prey on American citizens, it is not only the Nigerians who are criminal, it is the federal government officials who permit it. The massive immigration of the past three decades has spawned organized crime that far eclipses in sheer numbers of criminals and criminal acts, the mafia and other criminal syndicates during Prohibition. New ethnic criminal mafias include the Mexicans from drug importation to the street gangs, Chinese, Japanese, South Koreans, Colombians, and Russian, which are actually Jewish. Sicilian organized crime participants are today only minor players compared with the new non-European mafias. The extraordinary cost of organized crime is one more terrible cost accrued by the immigration policies of the United States. Just one aspect of organized crime, the drug problem, has a ripple effect that goes far beyond that of the criminal prosecution and incarceration of the drug dealers. How many broken lives and shattered families are its toll? How many crimes can be attributed to the addicts? How much has drug abuse and addiction affected welfare, housing, food stamps, and medical costs? Another intrinsic cost of legal and illegal immigrants is the high cost of their health care, which is routinely provided by the taxpayer. Of the 22 million Hispanics in America, at least 6 million are uninsured. When one adds the millions of blacks receiving Medicaid and overflowing the public hospitals of the major cities, one begins to understand the crisis in the health care crisis. Those who do not pay for their medical care, whether by insurance or other means, cause healthcare prices to go up for those who do. Productive Americans pay spiraling taxes that increasingly burden the middle-class family. And when an American who can't afford medical insurance, this is a side note for the audio edition, when they have medical problems, they pay higher rates because the hospitals must adjust for those who don't pay, and the illegal aliens don't pay. At 9.1%, immigrants receive welfare cash benefits at a higher percentage than do native-born Americans. In some of the heavily black immigrant groups, it is higher. For example, 27.9% of Dominicans are on welfare. No one knows how many other are on non-cash programs such as food stamps, public housing, and Medicaid. In those programs such as public housing, which are administered by localities, there is evidence that the immigrant numbers are even higher. Alien immigration and welfare birth rates also increase education costs. California is so burdened by the bankrupting costs of large numbers of illegal immigrants in the schools that voters overwhelmingly approved Proposition 187, which limited public funding of illegal immigrants. When a segment of the school population does not pay its fair share of education costs, either the quality must go down or already high taxes must continue to rise. Some so-called conservatives, such as the white renegade Republican politician Jack Kemp, are actually applauding the changing racial makeup of America, even though the non-white immigrants vote overwhelmingly for liberals. Many support opening the border even wider for the third world masses. The liberal media are ecstatic over the change. Multiculturalism is the new catechism of our schools, offered as the new definition of what is called America. As a side note for the audiobook, we just recently elected Barack Obama. But who elected Barack Obama? He received a landslide of the non-white votes, but a landslide, actually, of white voters voted for John McCain. The difference was the demographic change that has taken place in America. Of course, there were a lot of guilt-ridden and program whites who the media programmed to vote for Mr. Obama. But he really has not been any sort of change we can believe in. He's more of the same establishment malarkey. In the American mythos, we have gone from a nation of pioneers to a nation of immigrants, to a nation of multiculturalism and multiracialism. We pay for this change in crime rates so high that they challenge the term civilized society. We pay in schools where our children are, at best, taught at a substandard level and where, at worst, face physical intimidation and abuse. Payment is made in inordinately high taxes and a declining infrastructure to finance the machinery of welfare, food stamps, housing, medical care, and criminal justice and incarceration. White Americans pay in the racial discrimination of affirmative action. And we pay spiritually as the media instill in us a guilt complex, a sense of guilt that fosters accusations of racism. Future generations of our people will find it amazing that so few whites during the last decades of the 20th century and the first decade of the 21st century could face up to the grim reality of the racial change. The election of Barack Obama is, however, waking up many in these times. Those who read these lines in the mid-21st century will think, why couldn't white Americans see what would happen to their society when they became outnumbered and outvoted? As the white taxpayer base shrinks and the number of minorities increases, non-white newcomers and newborn will demand more and more of the money generated by white productivity. The unproductive many will vote for confiscatory tax rates against the productive few. The decline of society will be rapid and catastrophic. Of course, the decline will be rapid only in historic terms. For those living through it, the change will be far less perceptible. Multiculturalism is by its very definition non-American. Either America is an American culture or it's multicultural. It cannot be both. Most white liberals I've encountered envision America's future composition as somewhat like their own upscale neighborhoods, mostly white, but with a scattering of minorities who will fit nicely into the liberals' wine and cheese set. But continued high non-white immigration, accompanied with high non-white birth rates, will not create a society in which the third world types are present in slightly larger numbers than today. It will produce a society in which the non-Europeans will become the vast majority, and we, the white minority, a tiny and diminishing white minority, will be totally under their control. The fact is that the notion of multiculturalism is a lie, for it demands the destruction of Western culture. When Jesse Jackson and his black and Mexican minions demonstrated at the University of California at Berkeley, they chanted, quote, "Hey-ho, hey-ho, Western culture has to go," unquote. But even more than our culture, what's at stake here is the very survival of our form of life on this planet, the very right of our people to continue the distinctions that make us what we are. In the end, we will be forced to assimilate into their culture and genotype, not them to us. Martha Farnsworth Rishi, director of the Bureau of Census in the Clinton administration, happily offers the following comeuppance to white Americans, and I quote, "Without fully realizing it, we have left the time when the non-white, non-Western part of our population could be expected to assimilate to the dominant majority. In the future, the white Western majority will have to do some assimilation of its own," unquote. Many of those, and by the way, the documentation again is in my hard text. Please order the book, My Awakening, complete with the new index and a lot of updates from the old edition. Most of those who can see what's happening cannot muster the courage to speak out openly and endure the approbation of the media. The oft-repeated refrain of American government and media is that to be opposed to unlimited immigration is, quote, un-American, against the very principles upon which our founding fathers created in this nation. As I researched this issue, I found that just as on the black-white issue, the media had embarked on a massive misinformation campaign. Of course, it is the massive non-American alien invasion that's un-American. Consider the following quotation from American Heritage magazine, quote, "What is at stake here is nothing less than the essential nature of the United States of America. Only the United States takes special pride in describing the American nationality as, by definition, independent of race and blood, as something that is acquired by residence and allegiance regardless of birthplace or ancestry." In fact, America's first naturalization law, which our founding fathers enacted in 1790, mandated that an applicant for citizenship be a, quote, "free white person," unquote. Even the Declaration of Independence often refers to our, quote, "British brethren," our common kindred, and our consanguinity. In the original Constitution of the United States, Article 1, Section 2, Negroes are counted on the census as 3/5 of a human being. John Jay, in his first essay on the Federalist Papers, refers to Americans as, and I quote, "One united people, a people descended from the same ancestors, speaking the same language, professing the same religion, attached to the same principles of government, very similar in their manners and customs, a band of brethren," unquote. Does one have to wonder what John Jay would have thought of gangster rap and the 12 days of Kwanzaa? Of Mexicans crossing our borders by the millions, of thousands of AIDS-infected Haitians landing on our beaches, and direction signs in Spanish along Main Street. Another excellent example of the media distorting our founding fathers' real positions on race and immigration is the use of oft-quoted lines by Thomas Paine proposing that America be an asylum for mankind. The lines are from Common Sense, the pamphlet that so ardently argued for American independence. In it, Paine made abundantly clear that the mankind to whom he referred was European, and I quote, "We claim a brotherhood with every European Christian. All Europeans meeting in America or any other quarter of the globe are countrymen." The Constitution of the United States in its preamble states the matter in very clear language. "We, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, and to promote the general welfare and secure the blessings of liberty for ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution of the United States of America." Unquote. Author Peter Brimlow notes in his book Alienation, it was the founders' posterity, our posterity, they wrote about, not posterity in general. Interestingly, the same racial groups that advocate immigration in the name of pluralism and multiculturalism hunger for the day when they will be in the majority. Far from willingly becoming part of the traditional Anglo-Saxon American heritage, many of the immigrants have the unabashed goal of altering America to resemble their own native lands. One of the major Mexican-American organizations over the past few decades has been the mestizo equivalent of the NAACP, La Raza Unida. It and other organizations are titled in Spanish, and most of their publications are almost exclusively written in Spanish. Their publications often contain articles lamenting the, quote, Anglo-American theft of the Southwest and the coming political dominance, they support, of the mestizo. Some advocate political reunification with Mexico, while others are working toward forming a new Mexican nation to be called Aztlanda in the American Southwest. What a word, Aztlanda. Very appropriate. No wonder Mexican-American groups refer to themselves as La Raza Unida. They don't translate the name to English, for the translation would reveal their raison d'etre, for La Raza Unida means the United Race. New section, birth rates and race politics. Black leaders are more open about their aspirations. Morris Jeff, director of the New Orleans Welfare Department, and former president of the National Association of Black Social Workers, was asked about the social and personal damage from the high illegitimate birth rate among black welfare recipients. Jeff, the person supposedly responsible for programs to reduce poverty and the dissolution of the black family, asked his interviewer to look around at the predominant black faces in City Hall and pronounced that blacks wouldn't control the city's politics without the high black welfare birth rate. Jeff said, and I quote, "Should they have children? I don't think they should not have children. I think reproduction patterns are based on self-interest, although not in any conscious sense. When you look at the gains the black community has made, it hasn't been based so much on opportunity as on the profoundness of numbers. In the political arena, you count votes. The best self-interest of the black community is for it to have its numbers. I could not support a position that would decrease our numbers. In some instances, this is what Darwin was talking about. The name of the game is just to be there in the future." Jeff also states the grim reality that faces white people more honestly than does any white politician, except perhaps myself. He muses, quote, "It's," referring to the high birth rate among blacks, "it's not just an idle concern for white people. There is a future self-interest involved in this thing. It has a profound effect on the future, and I think there are those in the white community who are threatened by it, not only nationally, but internationally." So true. For a generation conscientious, well-read, environmentally concerned, high IQ white Americans have been told that the overpopulation of America will destroy the environment and lessen the quality of life for all. Books such as Overpopulation, expert Paul Ehrlich's bestseller, The Population Bomb, urged the renunciation of children, or at least limiting the family to one child, as an ideal of the truly altruistic. One problem with such a scenario is that the only ones intellectual enough to read such a tome or foolish enough to sacrifice themselves will be the practitioners of the intelligenticide. The second problem is that The hordes of legal and illegal immigrants flooding America will never read the population bomb. Even if they did, they would not refrain from their immigration nor their birth rates because of what they would consider Ehrlich's sentimental environmentalism. Next section, race, immigration, and the environment. Ironically, because of our immigration policy, all the environmental concerns about birth rates for Americans is pointless. Americans of native stock have long had a birth rate below replacement level. Almost all of our rapid population increase comes from immigration, and the high birth rates of those immigrants are already here. The discriminatory policy of U.S. immigration law keeps people of very low birth rates out, such as Europeans and white South Africans, while favoring fecund third worlders. Additionally, most legal immigration today comes from so-called family unification provisions that simply augment the immigration from those non-white cultures that have the highest birth rates and that remain prolific in the United States. America now spends an incredible 2.1% of the gross national product, almost $115 billion a year, on environmental protection, and it's going up dramatically. We are willing to lose jobs to foreign countries that have no such environmental constraints and costs. We are willing to pay more in taxes and pay higher prices for everything from manufacturing products to garbage removal. Unless immigration and the high non-white birth rate are curtailed, all that expenditure and the essence of the ecologic dream for America will be wasted. Nothing harms the environment more than overpopulation. Practically every scientist, biologist, researcher, and writer who wants to preserve the ecology of our nation recognizes that the most critical factor of environmental quality and ecologic preservation is population size. Resource-poor and environmentally challenged America already has to close the gates of national parks because of the sheer number of people. The Southwest is running out of water. The wetlands of Louisiana face the ecologic Armageddon of saltwater intrusion. The great forests of America are shrinking. Every year, thousands more concrete parking lots replace meadows and forests. Ecologically, America is right now on the cusp of disaster. Yet, out-of-control immigration and welfare birth rates promise 150 million more people in just the next 50 years, more than the first 300 years of European settlement on this continent. We do not want our redwood forest chopped down or paved over or our wetlands drained and made barren. We curse at the morning traffic gridlock and remember a time when it was not so jammed, when there was plenty of space in American cities for a home rather than a two-bedroom apartment, when one could drive across America on a two-lane road and encounter only a couple of hundred traffic lights instead of thousands. When one did not have to go to state parks to find miles of pristine beaches uncovered by high-rises, cheap motels, or the homes of the privileged elite. Although Europeans were the first people on Earth who developed the technological ability to do wholesale damage to the environment, we were also the first to recognize it and curtail it. We're the only people productive enough to afford the high costs of environmental protection, and, as demonstrated by every white population in the world, we are responsible enough to limit birth rates. In the third world, there is no such vision, and in their corrupt and overpopulated societies, they do not make the same choices about the future of the planet as we do. Without question, the greatest man-made ecological disaster in the history of the world is the ongoing destruction of the Amazon rainforest. The flora of the Amazon filters the Earth's atmosphere and replenishes its oxygen, much like the filter and air pump in a home aquarium. Fueled by unbridled birth rates and widespread stupidity and corruption that permeates every level, the mixed race multitudes of Brazil devour ever greater expanses of the forest. Like human locusts, they leave in their wake land scarred and exhausted and move on to consume more of the virgin forest that has the world's richest Eden of plant and animal life. The leaders of America and the West also must take a share of responsibility for the disaster, for their idiotic charity of aid and special trade policies has sustained both the birth rate and given the despoilers the economic incentives of this ecologic nightmare. The unrestrained money lust of international capitalism has also been a large player. It is not surprising that the same ultra-capitalists who have historically favored the importation of slaves and since then the immigration of cheap third-world labor increasingly locate their manufacturing plants in areas of the world where labor and environmental standards are inferior to those in America and Europe. In a natural order coming in the next century, we must make the rape of the earth as intolerable a crime as the rape of a woman. And every policy of trade and commerce, aid, or diplomacy will be greatly affected by a nation's concern for the earth's environment and ecology. In that natural order, money and the accumulation of wealth will no longer be the law and the spirit and the arbiter of human affairs. As I write these words, I'm visiting friends in northern Italy, and from my balcony, and I'm there again today as I read this, by the way, and from my balcony I can see the beautiful Lake Garda lying below the town of Torre del Benico. All the population around Garda is European. My days have been blessed here by seeing the harmony of the all-European school children, the trash and crime-free streets and highways, and the architecture of beauty and strength built to last centuries, not simply mere decades. Only a few weeks before, I drove through the ugly visage of miles of garish high-rises on Miami Beach, which in its pristine state must have been one of the most beautiful beaches in the world. As I gaze out at Lake Garda, I contemplate Lago di Garda. I contemplate how different it is from Miami and just soak in with my soul this emerald lake at the edge of the Alps. Quaint villages dot the green expanses in the mountains, and a few accent the shores of the freshwater lake that is truly fresh, fed only by the purity of mountain streams. The lake is ringed in the north by magnificent mountains, their summits reaching up to the skies like white steeples. The colors are the most vivid beheld by the human eye, and in this green and blue and white house of worship, it's easy to understand how man, if he is to live, must control his greed. Years ago, the people of the lake decided that man's encroaching presence had to be curtailed. It is extremely difficult to get permission to build a house or any structures in the region. It is true that every landowner around Garda could become rich if their beautiful land would be developed like that of Miami Beach. But the people here know that if that happens, the beauty is spoiled, the quality of life is crowded and lessened, the lake is polluted, ultimately replacing the perfection of nature by the imperfection of man. Because of the ecological foresight of the people of Garda, it is possible for us now to see its true beauty. Higher motives and more vital needs than greed have prevailed here, and the lake region will be here 100 or 1,000 years hence, as it is now. If the people do not lose their way, it will remain as it is for 1,000 or even 10,000 years from now. To think that my descendants, long after my passing, will be able to come here and see it the same way that I see it now, touches a chord in my heart. The lake's beauty, resting in harmony with its people, reinforces the lessons of race, demographics, ecology, and economics. Until those who are concerned about the preservation of the Earth's ecology become concerned about the preservation of our European human ecology. The planet has no hope of environmental salvation. The next section is, what is a nation? In the English language, the word nation is derived from nascere, a Latin word meaning to be born. Inherent in the word is a sense of generation or descent. It has the following definition from the Random House Electronic Dictionary. Nation, noun, 1. A body of people associated with a particular territory that is sufficiently conscious of its unity to seek or to possess a government peculiarly its own. And 2. The territory or country itself. In a real sense, then, nation means a people conscious of itself, seeking a government peculiarly, it's a hard one to say, its own. It is far more than simply a territory or piece of geography, a country. Such a definition magnificently expresses what the modern nation states came to mean. It explains the tyranny and the ultimate disunity and strife that comes with a geopolitical state that is based not so much in a common ethnic heritage, but a political formation carved out by the force of religion, hereditary title, or simply conquest. Each nation possesses a government, specifically its own. Whether the nation is composed of one race or ethnic derivation or a multitude of races. Of the Western nations, there is more harmony in those that have more ethnic unity and more strife and alienation in those that are more multicultural and multiracial. Even the small genetic differences between groups of one race can have dramatic consequences, especially in combination with religious division. One can see such in Northern Ireland and what was once Yugoslavia. The disintegration of Yugoslavia after the fall of communism is an example of the triumph of the national principle, created artificially in the ashes of the First World War from the breakup of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. The only considerations used in the creation of Yugoslavia were political ones. Ethnic cultural realities were ignored in that creation. Only the imposition of royal dictatorship in the 1920s and then the communist tyranny until the 1980s could suppress the national and spiritual longings of the various peoples. The Croats, the Serbs, the Bosnians, and the other ethnic minorities all wanted a government to reflect their own heritage and their own character. As more democratic freedoms emerged, an inevitable conflict and division occurred as well. Democratic government brought with it a more accurate expression of the sentiments of the people as opposed to the unnatural governments imposed by power. Governments often see one ethnic segment impose its will over another. The segment in power is usually in the majority, but it is sometimes a minority. When the majority group dominates, there is almost always less opportunity and happiness for the minority elements. When a minority ethnic group has power over a majority, political and economic suppression is inevitable. Otherwise, it could not for long sustain its power. The driving force of ethnic nationalism exists in all nations where there are sizable minorities, whether it be in Uganda or in the United States, in Zaire or New Zealand. The greater the respective percentages of the minorities, inevitably the greater the conflict. That conflict can be lessened when the minorities have a degree of autonomy in their own regions. Genetic differences imprinted by tens or even hundreds of thousands of years find expression in unique cultural, economic, social, and political terms. Within nations, they can be manifested by social segregation, whether it be in the white flight in America or distinct neighborhoods of Irish Catholics or Scottish Protestants in Northern Ireland. Differences between Scots and Irish are very minor in comparison between the gulf between, say, Scots and Ugandans or Irish and Ugandans. Yet the differences are still enough to result in a clash of cultures and wills that result in hatred, strife, and violence. Differences between people of European origins are small enough to be overcome by intense social interaction, and by unifying culture, as shown by the example of the United States. In Northern Ireland, however, the ethnic difference is exacerbated by sharp religious division as well as by long-standing political confrontation. The combination of these three factors leads to almost irreconcilable differences. Multiculturalism can be imposed only by tyranny. It is never a result of the free will of the people. In almost every case, governments that have embarked on multiracial immigration policies have done so in opposition to the people's wishes. Widespread popular opposition to immigration found in America also exists in every other nation enduring massive alien immigration. Canada, Britain, France, Germany, and Italy have all had public opinion polls showing strong opposition to immigration, while their governments have embarked on opposite policies. Proposition 187, which California voters approved by a wide margin in 1994, sought to restrict taxpayer funding of government services to illegal immigrants, but the courts have prevented its implementation. What will happen to the political, social, and cultural desires of native Californians, those who made the state so attractive in the first place, when immigrants make up the majority of California's voters? Real freedom is possible only in societies essentially made up of one race and oriented to the national and natural desires and values of that heritage. The massive immigration in America of the last decades of the 20th century and the first few of the 21st century, combined with taxpayer-subsidized minority birth rates, will lead to conflict that will challenge the very foundations of America. If the people of European descent are knowledgeable, dedicated, and willful, they shall prevail. If they are weak, they and their works of beauty, all the material achievements, and even their genotype itself, their living example of life on this earth, will be washed away in the remorseless tides of history. At the same time that I learned of the real threat to our very existence as a people, I began to learn about the attack on our people's most basic and fundamental structure, the family. The same egalitarian forces that proclaimed racial equality allege that the fundamental psychological difference between the sexes were caused by environmental conditioning. They began to tear at the fabric of the family itself. And ladies and gentlemen, the next chapter is chapter 13, called Sex and Society. It deals with the destruction of the family, modern leftist feminism, which is anti-family and really anti-woman, and other discussion dealing with homosexuality, sexual mores, and the impact of sex, marriage, life on society.